There's another show coming up at the Odyssey you shouldn't miss. A short run of Kevin Flynn's terrific one-man piece, Fear of Heights, returns from April 5 to 14. Kevin's very funny and insightful show is about his magic carpet ride from a working-class family to, well, almost A-list stardom in Hollywood. Almost. We couldn't resist replaying part of an interview I did with Kevin back in September that includes the moment he decided to step off the magic carpet at the age of 29. Today, I'm with Kevin Flynn, whose one-man show, Fear of Heights, is currently playing at the Odyssey in West L.A. I saw it last night. I loved it. I wanted to talk to him right away because the theme of the show is kind of staying human. And so, welcome.
Thanks. It's nice to be here. I'm glad you made the show last night and made me feel human.
All right. Good. Well, the show opens with a very famous photograph.
Right.
And maybe you can tell us about that.
Well, the famous photograph is, it's called Men Having Lunch on a Beam. It's that picture that most people know. It's that famous ironworker picture where this steel beam is across the Manhattan skyline. There's 69 floors above the city streets, and the furthest on the right is a man holding a small bottle, and that turns out to be my grandfather, a man named Paddy Flynn. That's where the story starts, basically. And now I'm here doing this.
So Kevin is not a steel worker. Kevin is a well-known actor, stand-up comedian, writer, now playwright as well. You may know him from Sex and the City as the boyfriend of Charlotte.
Charlotte's boyfriend.
So young, incredibly good-looking.
Yeah, and it was actually the first time she was topless in the show.
Yes, you will get insider tidbits about Hollywood like that, but that isn't what the show's about, and it's not what we really want to dive into today. Let's get back to that picture, because a lot of the show is about your growing up in a steelworker family in New York.
Yeah.
Right? The ethos of that, the lost ethos, maybe, of that time?
Sure. Well, it's basically, I don't think I was supposed to be a third generation iron worker. My parents were basically, my grandfather was that man on that iron beam, and we were the Flynns. We were iron workers. My grandfather, my father, my uncles, my cousins, everybody was an iron worker. We were all expected to be iron workers. So, but I grew up with this sort of respect the working man mentality, where people work hard and you come home and you provide for your family. And my father was very honest and a hardworking man. And so I thought about my grandfather, and then I thought about my father, and then I thought about me, and then I realized it was for my daughter, to let maybe my daughter see. I watched the sacrifices that my grandfather and my father made, basically on my behalf. Here I am, an actor, a writer, a comedian. I didn't have to be a steelworker because of the hard work they put in for me in that way, the gift that they gave me.
So I want to talk in this show a little bit about that previous time and something that's kind of been lost. And you do a wonderful impression of your father and some of the things that he said about his work, about bringing
My dad was, he was a big guy. My father was 6'2", and so was my grandfather. I'm 5'9", so he was this big sweetheart of a guy, though. But he had this funny way about him where he'd always be like, they'd get hurt at work, and he'd be like, Kev, part of the package, pal. Part of the package, pal. It's what you can do. It's all you can do. Just part of the package. So he always had these sayings that he would repeat to me over and over, like, nothing worse than a man who's lazy, pal. Nothing worse than a man who's lazy. Nothing worse than a man who's cheap. Nothing. Terrible trait, pal. Nothing worse. So he kind of kept me on that respect the working man, hard work, the sacrifices that people make.
So you can hear in there that Irish accent.
Oh, yeah.
And the audience, I'm sure, knows that photo of the steel guy sitting on the steel beam, 1932, Rockefeller Center being built.
Yeah.
And far on the right is a aging iron worker with four fingers.
Four fingers on his left hand, yeah.
And he's holding a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And that was your grandfather.
Yep.
Paddy Flynn. So I want to hear a little of Paddy Flynn.
Paddy was really off the boat, and so his accent was a lot, deeper. And when my father wanted to go to college to become an architect, my grandfather would be like, boy,
College. There's nothing like college. You know, no need for college. The boy's going to climb the beam, climb the steel with the rest of the family when he graduates from high school. He's going up with a beam, climbing the family steel.
You know, then I do my other grandfather who he was from Northern Ireland, so his accent was a little different. Okay. But I broke my leg playing soccer in two places, and he comes running out. He's like, all right, now get up. It could be worse. Could be worse. Could be a lot worse than that. You could have broken both legs. How's that for worse?
Could be worse than that, even. You could be dead. Dead and buried. Lying 6 feet under the ground, looking up, saying, oh boy, how I wish I was back up there now with my one little wee broken leg.
And my dad's on the other side of the field. Get up, you fairy. That's what you get for kicking it.
So, by the way, if you go to the show, Kevin conjures all kinds of characters from not just his family, but from Hollywood. And I know in your stand-up routines, it's a lot character-based of kind of people you've met and so on. So
yeah,
that's a teaser. And we're going to hopefully get more teasers like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But before we, you know, move on from, I'm kind of obsessed with this idea that, like, people used to have a respect for work, mm-hmm. like working people,
right,
that they don't have anymore. You know, like you think about every Hollywood movie where, you know, they're working a menial job and then they discover their talent and they move on, you know, spectacularly,
yeah,
right? And they leave that behind. And, you know, your own story is a little bit there, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, so I have this book, and I wanted to surprise you by showing you this. These are photographs by a guy named Irving Penn, very famous photographer, from the 1950s. It's called Small Trades. And this is from an exhibit that was at the Getty a few years ago. And he wanted to show the dignity that was in the faces of people doing work in those days, because he knew it was disappearing.
Right. Really, in the 50s,
In the 50s, he said, these are the last people who understand really what blue-collar work means and who respect themselves. And if you look at the faces of these people, you know, there's a stone cutter and a hod carrier, and there's probably steel workers in here, iron workers.
Yeah.
But there's, like, they have this pride.
Craftsmen, and they took pride in their work. You know, it's funny. My father has a theory. He felt that after World War II, people were so thankful to have a roof over their heads, a place to send their kids to school, a car in the driveway, food on the table. He felt the further we got away from World War II, the less people would understand the sacrifice that we all made for each other as a nation,
yeah,
as a world. And I think, unfortunately, I feel like some of that's coming true. I don't think we're, you know, I think with a lot of times work, the pride that goes into work, now people just say, well, how much do you make? How much do you make?
Yeah.
And it's the hedge funds and it's the Wall Street and they're making all the money. And you're sort of like, well, but someone who bakes bread, someone who builds buildings, somebody, you know, like you're talking to one of the, you had a deep sea diver, one of those pictures, a chef. It's like people take pride in their work, and it would sustain a family. And now it's, some of these jobs are very hard to raise a family, raise yourself if you're a chef or at a restaurant, a cook. I see these taxi drivers in New York City, they're working 2-3 jobs and they still can't live in the city. You know, it's just a hustle now all the time, multi-gigs. And I just feel it's too bad, you know. And so this whole thing about work is part of what's in this play, because I think, you know, boy, they worked hard to allow me to have other opportunities. But I have to learn how to do my job and take pride in it and work hard at it, you know.
So in the play,
yeah,
I guess it's a play. It's the whole thing's kind of a memoir,
right?
A fun memoir, I should point out.
Yeah.
And the title Fear of Heights comes from the fact that the reason you didn't become an iron worker, the sole reason apparently at the time, was that you were afraid of heights,
right?
And you wouldn't tell anybody, so you said you're Plan B.
My plan B was, well, my first was to be a soccer player. I wanted to be a professional athlete. I did that. And I talk about, you know, how I couldn't be an iron worker. So what could I do? And I had this moment with myself when I was about 10, thinking like, oh, this panic set in. I'm afraid of heights. I can't tell anybody. And how can I really be a Flynn, this proud ironworking tradition family, if I'm afraid of heights? And I didn't want anybody to know that. And so I basically, in the play, you see where I kind of say, well, what can I do? And I decide, oh, become rich and famous. That's what I'll do. You know, just like, you know.
So you actually achieved fame and fortune, unlike most of us who attempt that not usually is our plan B. Usually our plan B is something else. So in the story, and I'm not going to have you trace your whole career,
yeah,
but give us the 30-second...
Well, as we all know, you have to have a lot of plans in this world because things change all the time. I played professional soccer for a couple of years. I got drafted out of college, and that was wonderful. But no fame and fortune there. Soccer in the late 80s was not the most popular thing around. But I was on the road a lot, traveling around the country, and I started to write, keep a journal, and try to make the guys laugh.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, I really enjoy this. I had always watched stand-up comedy thinking, I think I can do this. I think Catholic school was a great training ground for trying to make friends laugh under repressed sort of...
Under repressed conditions.
Repressed conditions. Yeah, I said oppressed. Repressed conditions. And so when I had a chance, I went to BU, to graduate school. I took the assistant coaching job there, the soccer coach for the soccer team. And the comedy scene in Boston was just on fire. I started to hang out with the comedy clubs, and clubs were packed. Started to write stand-up, and got up on stage, and wound up winning a competition. And so I won, and I became a professional comic at that point.
And the story that you told was about your Irish family. And
on stage, yeah.
On stage. So yeah. You were doing those impressions of your family. And
right. Yeah, my grandfather and one of my first stand-up bits, or actually the very first stand-up bit I ever wrote was about my family, about my dad. And I say I was from a very conflicted upbringing. And this is after you already hear how I had a pretty nice upbringing, right?
Yeah, you had a nice family.
Very nice family. And so I say, oh, it was terrible. It was conflicted. I was a soccer player. My father was a football player. He didn't understand soccer at all. He would just come to my games. He'd stand on the sidelines for 90 minutes, keep yelling, pick up the ball. Pick up the ball. They're all kicking around like a bunch of fairies. Pick it up and hit somebody. You're an American, for God's sakes.
It's hard work.
Yes.
Being an actor and a comedian, and, you know, it's not like there's some magic talent that fairy dust that comes down and makes it all happen, right? But
I basically, when I started to get on television a little bit as a stand-up comic, I moved out west, and I started to audition for things, and... one of the things that started to really happen for me was television hosting. So I wound up, the first television show I had was a show called Road to the World Cup on ABC Sports with Brent Musburger.
Uh-huh.
So I guess, and I sent a tape into ESPN as well, you know, with some of my soccer highlights from my playing career and my stand-up comedy. ESPN hired me as well. Then I shot a morning show pilot with Joy Behar. And then I got a show called Go For It on the Discovery Channel, which ran for a couple of years, which was wonderful. I traveled the world, and I did all these scary adventures, and I have a fear of heights. So
you talk in the show, you know, about making a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
About checks piling up on the dresser that you didn't even have time to cash.
Right.
And then there's a moment where you have kind of a reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little about that moment and how it changed your life.
Well, story. I've always set goals for myself. I'm very goal oriented, and I was working very hard to sort of make this a big jump into sort of a network career and big fame and fortune. I had it on a little bit of a scale. You know, you said I had it, but I had, you know, I felt I had it on a small scale. Mm. Wasn't enough. Sort of had this insatiable appetite to continue to move and do it. And I had even avoided relationships because I thought they got in the way of me achieving these goals. And the play, you know, and in my life, basically what happens is right when I start to get successful, my father has lung cancer, and then I get robbed at gunpoint.
Right. So before we get to that, very exciting. Mm-hmm.
Exciting for you.
Terrifying moment.
Terrifying, yeah, that's a better word.
So he got lung cancer from asbestos.
Asbestos, yeah.
From working on those skyscrapers in this very demanding, the job that we're respecting here and all that. And you talk about that. He got it.
Yeah, well, he worked amongst asbestos. I tell it in the play. I remember my father telling me when I was a kid, they were giving the men an extra 50 cents a day for a quart of milk at the end of the workday. So the theory was that it would coat their throats and stomachs from all the asbestos they'd inhaled over the course of the day, which was absurd.
Right.
Maybe thinking about now. And this was in the 70s. So, and my father was always like, hard day's work, honest day's work. You know, it's okay, honest day's work. Part of the package, you know, if you get hurt once in a while, part of the package. And so I mentioned it earlier in the play, and then sure enough, he, you know, has lung cancer, asbestosis. And they give the man just a couple of months to live, my father.
Yeah. You know,
from an honest day's work, I say.
And then that same day, was that the same day?
Same weekend. So it same happened. Weekend. Yeah, in the middle of the week, I get this call. You know, the thing is, I break up with my girlfriend. We break up. And basically, she wants to get married. I don't. I still have so many things I want to do in my life. And she, well, we break up. And 2 days later, my father has lung cancer, this diagnosis. And so she flies out to see me, to comfort me. And it's weird because we've broken up. We had this big breakup. And now my father has this terrible death sentence. And I'm sort of at a loss. I'm in a really weird place. And we have a dinner in here in L.A. and on a Friday night. And I drive back to my house. And we get robbed at gunpoint, walking to the front door. And I get pistol whipped. And they pull the gun. They push the gun to the back of my head as I'm lying on the ground. And I thought I was dead. I thought I was dead. And I thought, I'm going to die before my father does, this life that he's lived and everything he's done. And here I am, I'm going to die in my own driveway. And what have I done in this world other than thinking about myself?
Hmm.
And I thought, you know, here's a man who's given so much to me and to my sisters and to my mom and to his friends and his other family. And it's like, so I just sort of felt a bit shallow lying on that ground. And I thought I had made some bad choices in my life. I thought maybe some selfish choices. And I had a moment of just feeling like, wow, what am I doing? Is this success? I was probably 29.
Okay.
Yeah. 30, maybe just 30. And I thought, what am I doing? And I decided at that moment to say, I have to really realign my priorities. And my priority at that point was like, get married, start a family, and give back to what had been given to me as a young man growing up. And so I get married, and that doesn't really quite work out. As we all know, you know, when you get married, the fairy tale's over and the hard work begins. So I have a beautiful daughter out of it, and then it becomes about, I was laughing with someone after the show. Sometimes, you know, if you're in a bad marriage and you have a child, it's almost like a hostage situation. You would never really put up with certain things if you were single. Yeah. But because you have a child, you say you kind of look past your own needs and your own wants. Ultimately, it was the choices I made to sort of step away from the business a little bit because it took me away from this my daughter. And
so in the show, we learned not only did you step away, but, you know, your agent was calling you with major parts,
mm-hmm.
and you were turning them down until indeed they dropped you.
Yeah, at the end, yeah.
Uh-huh. But that moment, it's very interesting to me. You know, there's a phrase that I read in a newspaper article one time. It was about a homeless guy, but the writer in this moment of poetry said, "This man aspired to normalcy as to greatness."
Oh, I like that.
And that phrase has haunted me for 20 years since I read that. But I think about that, and I think about that with Hollywood folks, you know,
yeah.
that like, for the rest of us, no fame, fortune, not, you know, ESPN commentators or boyfriends of women of Charlotte, that if we ever achieved that, that would be the ultimate.
Right.
Right. And, you know, one learns not only that people who achieved that usually don't feel like, you know, you don't feel like you
were there. Right.
You were there. I have a friend who's a psychiatrist who said he had a patient who had won an Oscar. And in therapy, the famous director said, yeah, but that was 3 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Unbelievable.
Right.
Yeah.
And but that idea of aspiring to normalcy, you hear that?
I think that actually ties back to your pictures of these workers where this normal, wonderful life that they live. They raise a family, they bake bread, and they, you know, I think it's just, it's normal.
Yeah.
And so, and when, how come normal has not been enough now for people in lives in certain things? And why do we admire fame so much? And if, like, I sometimes want to say, amazing, he's working. How's his family life? You know,
yeah.
How are his kids? Do his kids know him? Do they see him? Because those kids only get one shot of being raised. And it's tough enough to be a famous person's kid, I would imagine. Never mind if they're not even there most of the time. So these are the choices we make. I have always found that sometimes I've found overachieving people don't have really a balance in their life sometimes. And that's what I've tried to aspire to at that point, to try and say, how can I, you know, release my creative instincts and do what I do, but be the best father I can be for this little person who I brought into this world.
You know what else I was thinking of when I was watching the show is the way modern people are forced to make up their lives, like, from scratch.
Yeah.
Like, your father, your grandfather, like, they didn't have to make up their lives, right? They
right.
knew what they were. That you go out, you earn a living, you have kids. Your grandfather had... You were the 21st grandchild?
Yeah, and there was a lot of them after me, too. He had six kids, so...
Oh, okay, there you
go. Six kids, yeah. And so they all had kids, and that was the whole deal.
Yeah, but they didn't have to, like, wake up in the morning every day and say, how am I going to optimize my life?
Right, yeah.
Right?
Right.
You think about that. Oh, my gosh. You know, we live with that in this crazy way.
You put your pants on and you went to work, you know? And I also say for my grandfather, even the right to do that dangerous job, he had a fight for it because they had a fight with their hands to be unionized. They had to fight people, literally, to get to a job site, to get, you know, I mean, it's just unfathomable to me in our generation. It's just, you know, I know a guy who actually, his kids were in the car in Hollywood here and they were driving and he was a director and the kids were talking in the back, and all the kids are tangentially in some way related to Hollywood. And they were talking about whose father had better box office draw that weekend. And actually, the mother was driving, and she came home and said, we're moving. We're going to move out of the city because this is ridiculous. 10-year-old kids talking about whose father did better at the box office that week.
You know, there's this moment where you've decided to go to get married.
Yeah.
And you're on your honeymoon in Italy.
Yeah.
And
as soon as I get there, there's an urgent message waiting for me at the front desk. And I'm fearing about my father and his battle with lung cancer. But I run down to the front desk, and it's from my agent. And it's really kind of my big break. It turns out to be something, a big network show. But I'm on the first night of my honeymoon. And the agent says to me, you got to come home and meet with these people. They're making a decision in 2 days. It's down to two people. You're both my clients. You got to get home. And I have suddenly this dilemma, you know, where I'm like, wow, wait a minute. I'm, you know, great. Okay, definitely. Because that's how I had always been, like, yeah, jump in the plane and go and do it. But I'm married now. So I have to go back and talk to my new wife, and it does not go well at all.
On your wedding night.
On my wedding night. Yeah, to my honeymoon. First night of my honeymoon. So it became a problem right away. I thought I was... you know, in an untenable situation right away. And it was a warning shot, really. So I don't go back. I don't go back for it. And it turned out to be a big network show that's been running for years. So we just won't say the name. It's a big reveal. And it's been going on for a long time, the show. So it would have been fame and fortune, basically, for me. But
yeah,
but I got a daughter instead. That's worth, you know, that's worth more money than anything in the world.
That's the greatness of normalcy.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
That's as much of the show as we can give away in this round. And I'll say thanks again to Kevin.
Thank you, Mark. This is wonderful. Let's all try to stay and remain human.
Kevin Flynn reprises his one-man show, Fear of Heights, at the Odyssey Theater in West Los Angeles, April 5 through April 14th. Don't miss it. Once again, this has been Mark Porter Zasada with Staying Human. You can find me at stayinghuman.net.